The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. Hey everyone, I'm Sarah Edmondson.
Hi, I'm Anthony Ames, Sarah's husband, aka Nippy.
And we're here to talk about things that are just a little bit culty. We were in a cult and we woke up, and it was all captured in a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, also in my memoir, Scarred.
And then we made this podcast. I guess you could say we're technically a cult show now.
But not your typical cult show. We're not so much about the grisly details. We are about kicking the doors down on the shame and the secrets that make these culty things so destructive.
We're here to have frank conversations about how cool things can cross over into the cultiverse. How to spot trouble when you see it, and what happens when it comes to recovering from something culty, if that happens to you.
Each week, we'll call on experts, advocates, fellow survivors, and whistleblowers to help us unpack what's going on in the cultiverse.
We're here to share what we know on everything from red flags to resiliency, and to have a few laughs along the way, because sometimes you gotta laugh.
Thank God. Now, we have a lot to cover, so let's get this show rolling, shall we? A Little Bit Culty Season 2 drops new episodes every Monday on the Acast app or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And to learn more, visit us on Instagram or at alittlebitculty.com. Good morning, Nippy.
Hello.
What voice was that?
I don't know. I'm just riffing.
How are you feeling about today?
I'm feeling good. Interesting subject matter, to say the least.
I feel like we're getting our stride in season two, and we're connecting the dot. At least I feel like I'm connecting the dots for myself in terms of the wide-reaching effects of these groups and how they infiltrate other industries in ways that are more than a little bit culty.
Mm-hmm. You're connecting the dots of the tapestry of abuse that exists in humanity.
That was so much better said. Yeah. It's so poetic.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, I'm in that flow right now.
Are you in the flow?
Yeah, a little bit.
I like when you're in the flow. That's one of my favorite quotes from you. When Nippy grows his hair long, he says, "You can't go pro without flow."
You can't go pro without flow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually that's a hockey one. Term because in college, I lived with a bunch of guys that played hockey, and they'd all wear their flow out. Outside the back of their helmet, like, "Oh, Ames, you can't go fucking pro without flow." I'm like,
all
right.
Had a lot of Canadian friends in your school, didn't you?
I did.
That's when you knew you wanted to marry a Canadian.
Yeah, that's right. That's when it all happened. Huh? These Canadian dudes are really cool. The women must be just as cool. I'm gonna
lock one down.
Lock one of those Canadians down.
Great. Well, speaking of being locked down,
Jesus Christ, right? Fuck.
The best segue. That's cool.
What's going on here?
Our guest is somebody that two people separately in our lives said, "You have to talk to this person." One was somebody that Nippy grew up with, Taylor.
Known since fifth grade.
She messaged us on Instagram. I think I put it on a list somewhere and then forgot to research. And then...
Well, we also have a lot of people telling us, interview this person, read this book. We have a lot coming at us, which is great. Don't stop doing it.
Keep it coming. Don't stop with the suggestions.
It's kind of hard for us to return serve all the time.
It's true. We've lost track of a couple.
Sorry about that.
That's Nippy's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. Well, I can give context to this.
Yes. Sure. Do that before.
When he was running for governor, all these sexual harassment charges were coming out from his bodybuilding days. And he did an apology and I didn't hear it. My brother Dewey got on some sort of media outlet. He said, "Listen to this. This is hilarious." And it's Schwarzenegger with the American flag behind him. He's like, "And to all the women out there that I may have offended, sorry about that." And my brother just kept rewinding, "Sorry about that. Sorry about that." And so whenever Sarah and I kind of have like, would you say a row or just, "Oops, sorry," we just go, "Sorry about that."
Sorry about that. So anyway, and by the way, that would never fly now, but
that's why it circled back 18 years later. I'm like, this dude's getting up there and he's like, "Sorry about that." Now people are getting canceled for it. Anyway,
well, let's just bookmark that story for next time. So Taylor says you have to talk to her name's Elizabeth. I'll introduce her properly in a second. And then also mutual friend and well-known actress, an amazing person, Bethany Joy Lenz, who knew my story, our story, has also come out of an abusive group dynamic in her own life. She said we got to talk to Elizabeth and that she had written a memoir about her time in a therapeutic boarding school. And I knew about that whole industry, also known as the troubled teen industry, because Paris Hilton has been outspoken about it. And, you know, that's been on my mind as something that I wanted to do a deep dive into, but actually reached out and connected with her before I read her memoir. And then I got it on Audible and couldn't stop listening. I mean, I actually had to stop a couple of times because I found it, I mean, for myself, triggering some of the
well, you stopped, and listened, and then you were like, listen to this, Nippy, listen to this. So you would explain it to me. So.
Yeah,
I was getting
Nippy and
I was getting the, I don't want to say highlights per se, but I was getting like the things of like, these are the abuses. Can you believe this happened, et cetera. So,
yeah. And just to summarize, for those who don't know what the troubled teen industry is that
they're called therapeutic boarding schools.
Yeah. So in the US, parents who had kids who were troubled or acting out or, you know, being teenagers were sent to these boarding schools where they could be, you know, therapized and fixed. And ultimately, many of them went thinking they were going to like a regular boarding school or in some cases to an outward bound program and spend some time in the woods and connect with nature. And but the parents, I don't think generally knew what was actually going on. And we're going to talk to Elizabeth more about that and how this industry was set up in a way that there really is, just like with cults, a bait and switch. You think you're doing one thing, but it's actually another thing. And I guess what I knew going into it is that there was definitely abuses of power and there was some processes that were abusive, but I didn't know how culty they were and also how many of these schools were actually using therapeutic exercises that were directly from what are now known as cults, specifically Synanon, which Amanda Montell spoke about in our second episode. So everything's kind of like coming back to the connecting the dots. Everything's coming together as like, oh, it's not just culty. It's the exercises that were also used in a cult, which came from Synanon as a derivative or as an offshoot of some people that went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not saying AA is a cult, but there are some practices that many people have reached out to us and pointed out that are culty. So anyway, everything's kind of coming together. But Elizabeth Gilpin is an actress and a writer and a producer, and she spent a couple years in one of these schools and also 3 months in the woods before that, which is part of their process. But I'll let Elizabeth tell us all about those details. And without further ado, Elizabeth Gilpin, the author of Stolen, a memoir about the troubled teen industry. For the people who haven't read your book, and just to get them a little bit up to speed, and just so you know, and I know you've listened to a couple of our episodes, our general format is for cult survivors is how did you get in, how did you get out, and how are you healing? And most people got in to something that they chose to do. They wanted to do something. They paid for it even.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case for you. Definitely not the case. You did not choose this path, but your parents did. I know I texted you this when I was reading the book. I was like, oh my God, I'm so mad at your parents. And then I had this list of questions like, have you forgiven your parents? Which I will get to. And I know that you have, but really it was your parents that got conned in terms of they made a choice. So I'm going to go back to that. It's like, can you paint a little bit of a picture of what was going on at the time in your life when they made a choice to send you off on this adventure?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely needed help. I was very angry. I was diagnosed with oppositional defiance disorder. I was actually just in New York and I was at the Child Mind Institute because I wanted to partner with nonprofits that help with the root issue, which in my mind, like the root issues of these places are, A, I was never diagnosed by an actual doctor. My ed consultant diagnosed me with oppositional defiance disorder. I wasn't diagnosed with anything else. Like I wasn't diagnosed with depression, which I certainly had. I wasn't diagnosed with like ADD or, you know, my brother had different learning disabilities and I knew that I had varying versions of them as well, whatever. So I was asking them, I was like, what do you treat? And they're like, well, we treat oppositional defiance disorder. That was one of the things I said. And I was like, oh, what do you do for it? And they were like, actually, a lot of it for that is working with the parents, not the kids. And I was like, oh, that would have been nice to know, you know, like 15 years ago. But yeah, so I was drinking, sneaking out. I had some bad luck. I had the car crash, which is pretty shocking to some people. But again, that was bad luck. Like I got in the wrong car. You know, it wasn't like I was going to buy heroin. The pot wasn't even for me. So I definitely had a problem, but I would say my problem, because I actually got sent away a lot for the drinking, the drugs, quote unquote, the partying. But I think my biggest problem was anger and depression.
I agree. From what you've shared in your book.
What I didn't want was to write an expose, like saying this person and that person's awful and exposing these places and not be honest about exactly where I was at.
For sure.
I was the hardest on myself with where I was at.
Absolutely.
You undermine your story when you're blaming others.
Yeah. So I tried to really go at myself.
We had to do the same thing. I get it.
In a lot of ways. Yeah. I mean, you can, there's ways you could be a little bit more gentler about how you're doing. It's inner honesty, and you're coming from, you know, where your story has its most potency is when you're vulnerable, honest, and that's really where your wisdom lies, right? So anyone going on this journey, it's in their best interest to at least, you know, do that, as opposed to I had a mean dad or, you know, my teacher did this, because then it's kind of, yeah. It's not as relatable too. And I think the courage is in doing what you just described, I think.
So I definitely tried to paint a very accurate picture of my depression and anger and the level to which I was partying. And that's not to say like I wasn't blacking out and like whatever. I definitely think maybe there was something in the middle of EFG before he went from A to Z.
Totally. That was actually one of my questions for you, was like, knowing what you know now. It was for the end, but I'm going to ask it right now. What would you tell people? What should they have done in that moment as opposed to sending you off?
Well, this is exactly why I was like, you know, because shutting these places down, as you guys know, is so hard. And these schools are privately run. They're not really monitored. No one's checking up on them. You know, there's no real way to know what's going on in these places. So shutting down a privately funded place is even harder. So I was like, I wanted my mission to kind of be, well, while we work on getting these places closed down, and because there's so many of these schools, that could take an eternity. So I'm like, if I could just give parents a better alternative of where to send their kids. So my school had lawsuits coming to it. There were kids trying to shut it down. But ultimately, why Carl Brook cited it closed was declined enrollment, because all over the internet, it was saying it was abusive. So, you know, people start to, you Google a school before you send their kids there. When I went there, it was so new there, and there were no smartphones or anything. There was nothing online. But by now, there's so much, like when you Google the school, what comes up is abuse, 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 abuse.
Good.
I'm hoping my book now comes up too. I actually just realized that I'm like, I haven't Googled the school to see if my book
I hope
up.
It does. And we hope that the podcast helps that too. But I apologize. I get so excited. Can you just go back for a second? So you were partying and doing, in my opinion, normal teenage things. And sidebar, if I'd lived in your town, I totally also would have been sent to that school, because everything you described, I think it's just like kind of part and parcel of being a teenager, you know? Yeah.
Minus the anger and depression for sure.
Yeah. But I mean, I was angry. I was angry. I actually went to an anger. I mean, listen, my parents are therapists, so I think that's the only reason why I didn't go your route. And I actually was sent to an anger management class when I was 16. Do you know that, Nip?
Yeah. I've heard all about it. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
When I wrote the book, I actually have said, and I try and say this loud and clear on everything I talk on, I did not only write this book for survivors of therapeutic boarding school, because I am, again, a big believer that the root issues stop a lot of problems, which is, I think if we dealt with a child's anger and insecurities and depressions and feeling, you know, I felt ashamed that I was angry and depressed and had all these feelings and I didn't know how to communicate them or articulate them or talk about it, whatever it was. So I'm hoping this book speaks to people, to kids who had those same feelings I had. So it kind of lets them know they aren't alone before it gets to the point where they end up in cults or however, you know, each had our own journey. But.
Well, to your point, you know, not a lot of schools have classes about anger or about joy or about emotions, right?
Especially in the South, right?
I don't think the South is proprietary. You can single them out.
That's my stigma from a Canadian point of view. I don't know.
And being married to me, Sarah, is that?
Yes. Yes. And being married to a Southern boy. Yeah.
But my point is those things have emerged as being certainly important to put in a curriculum somewhere. And if you're going to bang on the patriarchy, which is seems to be a popular thing to do, at least bang on them for that, you know, at least something that's going to be, you could usher in something that addresses what you're addressing. And it's part of a curriculum in education.
Yeah, I agree.
Just so our listeners know, so you were dealing with these things, your parents didn't have the tools to handle it. And tell us what happened. The Cliff Notes.
The Cliff Notes. I'm like, okay. So, well, the first time my parents tried to take me away was themselves. My parents were trying to drive me to the wilderness, except I thought I was going to Outward Bound, which even that I did not want to go to. But I tried to, Cliff Notes version of this crazy day, jump out of the car on the freeway. The cops happened to be behind us and saw and pulled us over thinking I was a kidnapped kid trying to escape. Of course, I told the cops I was kidnapped and those were not my parents and to save me, whatever. That was too much for my mother. So I got to go home after that, but only for a month. And then I say kidnapped lightly because I was not, you know, my parents paid the kidnappers. So I was escorted by people who woke me up in the middle of the night, took me from my bed. They said that your parents know we're here. We can do this the easy way or the hard way. Rip you out of bed. My mom took my sister and brother out of town, which I learned is very common for family members to leave and just one parent to stay. I learned that from hearing other kids' experiences.
Sorry, quick question. That was common. That was part of the practice to come in the night.
Not everybody. Like, so I knew a girl like who everybody, like it, all things are common. But if you had something like me where you got away or they knew you were going to be a runner or a problem, which I clearly was, then they tried to eliminate anyone who I could manipulate. Mm-hmm. And I was someone who was like, quote unquote, a runner, obviously. So they took extra precautions with me. My escorts take me to the woods. I'm strip searched. I knew immediately when I was strip searched that something was very wrong.
I was really pissed, by the way, when you were strip searched. I'm like, that is so inappropriate.
And you're 15.
I was strip searched so many times for the record, but I didn't know these places existed. So I did, I think in my mind, thought I was like going to be safe because my parents had set it up. And who's ever heard of this kind of place? Like most people, they still tell me as adults, they'd never heard of it until they read my book or until they saw Paris's Dock, whatever it was. I spent over 3 months in the woods and hiked. I mean, it was awful. I ate cold. We hiked in circles. We hiked miles. We would do night hikes. They would wake us up in the middle of the night and we would night hike. We would do like military pack drills. We had to like, you know, use the bathroom in the ground. I didn't shower for 3 months. It was awful. We did therapy once a week with a therapist, but then we sat down with the, I don't know if you want to call them camp counselors. I don't actually know what they were called, but those kids, a lot of them had gone to the woods themselves and then come back to work at it. So they obviously were not licensed to be working with children. They were like 5 years older than me.
Wow. Wow.
So I was doing treatment with kids who hadn't dealt with their own trauma of being kidnapped and sent there. And a lot of them were even, I don't want to say in denial, but refusing to accept they had even been abused. So that was who was treating me regularly on the day to day. And then on, you know, the once a week, I was meeting with an actual therapist who knows if he was licensed. I have no idea. So my parents were paying like $550 a day for me to be in the woods. Wow. And I think another $150 for every therapy session I had and for schooling, which I'm like, what school did I do there? I mean, I read The Alchemist and Man's Search for Meaning. That was it.
That's a racket. That's a big racket.
Yeah. But you know, I never say what woods I went to. I know people notice that because it's still open and I need this book to survive and not have lawsuits against it. My focus right now is the schools. Mm.
Right.
Because what happened in the woods was bad. The woods are terrible and abusive, but there is so much money in these programs. And I don't like know of any that have been shut down, but I will say that I think by a long shot, the most toxic, terrible part of it is the school.
Mm-hmm. How many schools are there out there that fall under therapeutic boarding schools?
I wouldn't even know how to answer that because there's just so many. There's international, like there's ones overseas, there's ones in the US, they're constantly closed. Like, okay, Carl Brook closed and it reopened as another version of it with different people, different schools, but it's another school just like it. So there's no way to track it because there's so many. But I was taken by the same escorts that took me to the woods, to Carl Brook.
So the woods and Carl Brook were still connected, obviously, because they have to work together.
The woods is a feeder program. Mm-hmm. So where they decide where to go. But some kids leave the woods and go home. Some kids, their parents pick them up. A lot of times, not a lot, but a handful of times, parents do pick up the child and take them to the school. Because I was a quote unquote runner problem child, my parents were advised not to take me because they thought I'd run in between the woods and the school. I think the reason that Carl Brook is so much more abusive than the woods, and let me just say this very loud and clear, I definitely think the woods are abusive, but Carl Brook was so abusive because the mental abuse, the cult stuff that we had to do, the running anger, the attack therapy at our classmates, like the way we were forced to, as 15-year-old kids, attack our friends, forced to, you know, tell them they were whores or whatever, basically take their deepest, darkest disclosures and attack them with them, and then have them do it to us, and then have adult men telling us we're sluts and whores. It was so psychologically abusive that when people ask me what was the worst part of Carl Brook, every part of it is the worst part of Carl Brook, but I am like the most disgusted by how, and I know it was survival, and I know I had to do it, because if I didn't do it, you got put on a program, you got sent to a psych ward, you got sent to a lockdown, you went back to the woods, and then if you went back to the woods, you would probably come back to Carl Brook and then stay another 6 months longer.
So you had to comply. You had to be obedient.
It was not like, if you don't comply, like you had to, because it was just make everything 6 months longer. They would tell us they'd keep us till we were 21 at a higher lockdown. But the way that I had to talk to other people, attack them, that to me, and I look at all the kids who took their own lives in these schools, and I look at how it affected me, and I'm a very strong person. And I struggled for years with drug addictions, with eating disorders, with everything, just to like cope with what I've been through or to run from it, to avoid facing it. And I look at like how much what people said to me affected me. And then I look at the people who took their own lives. And my big question I always ask myself is like, though I was forced, like what part did I play in this person not being able to come back? Because repeatedly I had to attack people. And they had to attack me, and the culture was built off of it. And it was every.
Did anyone learn a language in high school and then let it go and then have regrets about that later? If you're anything like me, then maybe you'll relate. I did French all the way up into 12th grade, and then I let it go. I mean, I lived in Montreal for a few years and, you know, practiced a bit, but it just slipped away. And then I found Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. And thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy little bite-sized language lessons, I've been able to get back my French. I've actually found learning French to be fun again. And c'est vrai, je parle français. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. And with Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Formidable. That means wonderful in French. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Clearly still working on that. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to babbel.com and use promo code CULTY. That's BABBEL.com, code CULTY. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Day.
I have to interject here two things. Your book is so well written and so riveting and so emotional. I texted you when I was done that I was like bawling my eyes out at the end and multiple times, and also had to put it down, like you said, in terms of, you know, trigger warning to people who've gone through other abusive regimes, cults, parents, groups, governments, whatever. It's going to be triggering. But I think it's ultimately cathartic, but like from someone who's gone through something similar to you in terms of what was done to us, like get careful about taking on too much responsibility, because like, it's good that you are, but like that wasn't your fault.
No, and I know it wasn't my fault, but I also watched Stanford Prison Experiment years ago. And like, I watched how the prison guards started attacking the prisoners. And that is basically what all of us had to do. And while I know it wasn't my fault and I was forced to do it and it was survival, like, of course, it's still one of those things where I'm like, yeah, you like forced or not, I still had to say terrible things. And I lost people I love, and I by no means blame their deaths. Like, I do not think I'm at fault for that.
Good, good.
But I definitely am aware of how much what they said to me affected me.
Yeah.
And I know it wasn't what they meant, or, and I know they didn't have a choice, but I know what, how much it hurt me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just saying I'm very aware, and that's what I think made Karl Brook so much more abusive than anything I've ever experienced in my life.
Absolutely. Well,
they created a culture of abuse.
Yeah, but the fact that they were making us do it to each other.
Yes.
Again, the fact that these adults were abusing us is not okay. But to then put that burden and that guilt on us to do it as well, as an adult, I'm like, that is just so horrible, because you know, I have to live with that for the rest of my life.
It also, it felt like that you couldn't really have the strong relationships, which would have made it a lot easier, like with your friend Maya, you know, and having her, you know, turn on you and betray you in a confrontation. I don't forget what they're called, but the where you confront each other in an appointment in group. Yeah. It served the school to make sure that people didn't know when their friends were going to betray each other.
It's tricky because I didn't look at it like, yes, maybe at 15, I looked at it like Maya betrayed me, but
I know, you know, now differently.
Maya's a tricky one because
explain who Maya is.
Maya, you know, the essence of Maya is she was someone who was my best friend at the school. We went through all the workshops together. The Maya characters, the point of putting her across was she was somebody who liked the school or wanted to love the school and wanted to believe that that school was helping us. And there were a handful of kids that, as you know, from being in cults, that never stop believing the place is good. No matter what comes out about it, they believe the place helped them. And then there are people like me who, even when I was there, was like, this place is disgusting. I didn't understand the extent of the abuse at 15, but I knew it was wrong and I knew it didn't feel right. But that being said, I really loved her. Some of those people, we didn't see eye to eye and we were never going to be friends there or after, but some of them I really loved and they were my friend as best, you know, despite the ups, the downs, the shit we had to say to each other. And I guess you could call them betrayals, but I don't think with her, it wasn't a betrayal. I think she genuinely wanted to help me. But what made her so special was that she genuinely did love everyone and like wanted to see the best in everyone and everything. And I think that's such a gift, but ultimately I think that's also in this instance, you know, hurt her as well. Mm-hmm. Like I wish that I trusted people more, because my biggest fault is I just don't trust anyone. But we basically started butting heads over Karl Brook. She loved it and I hated it. And as a result, when we got out, I didn't see her again. And my biggest regret was letting the school get in the way of my relationships with people there. Because certainly there were people I did not see again because I did not agree with their views on the school. Because it was just too hard. I'm sure for them it was the same, a reminder of, you know, what we had been through. And I knew it was bad and they wanted to believe it was good. And maybe it was good for them. You know, I'm not any of these people, so I can't speak for them.
What's that like for you now?
It's hard for me, especially when I look at, again, I say very clearly in the book, I don't know why a lot of these people took their own lives. I will never know. I was not there. You know, nobody will ever know. But I know that in my real life, like my life today, that I don't have lists of people passing away. But I know that, you know, even since this book has gone to print, there has been another kid take their own life. So that name is not in print because the book was already printed. I know that the common denominator for about 45 kids that I found, and that means there are more, like there are people nobody ever heard from again that I would never know how to found, or they were there before me or whatever, for whatever reason, I don't know. But 45 that I found who have taken their life or passed and some, you know, one was murdered, fine. But that's just the common denominator is Carl Brook. And that's a very large number considering it's open for, you know, barely over a decade. And not that it's not like there were, you know, 1,000 kids there at a time.
You've certainly detected a pattern at the very least.
So yes, I don't know that that school is why these kids did it, but there is a, the common denominator is Carl Brook. So it's hard for me to stomach. And I knew putting this book out, the kids, the families, whoever it was, were not going to like this book for many reasons. It was going to be hard to read it. Maybe they were going to have to look at it in a different light, whether or not they were going to accept it or not, that's on them. But I knew for many reasons, this book was going to upset a lot of people.
Question for you there. So are those people that were there with you, are they in denial that it was an abusive atmosphere?
I don't know. I don't want to speak for them and say they're in denial.
Well, it's case by case, but generally, do you feel like you have people that are like, no, it wasn't abusive?
Yes, there are, but there are way more that say it was. But of course, there are people that still are like, no, this place saved my life. Huh. That will always be the case, but that's any cult, that's any abusive institution. Like, it's like an abusive relationship. Women stay in love with the guy for, you know, it's hard. It's Stockholm Syndrome. Yeah. You do not want to accept it. If you accept that you went to an abusive school, that means your parents allowed it to happen.
Sure, there's a lot of things you have to reconcile.
Other things that I've had to wrestle with. Well, and that doesn't mean I think my parents are to blame. They were conned too. But as a child, my parents sent me to an abusive school. And that's something I've grown to accept. So do I know if they're in denial? No. But I think reading this book, you have to, if you really open your heart to it, accept things that aren't easy to accept.
Sure.
How are you with it now? Like what's your life like with it? I mean, obviously you're doing press for the book and you're talking about it again. Is it triggering you? Or are you feeling strong?
I had a moment when it came out that was really hard, which I'm sure both of you have been through, where I just said to someone, I was like, I don't even want to get out of bed. And so I went and stayed at a friend's house for like a week because I was trying to hold myself accountable to get up. And part of that was knowing that I had hurt people. And part of it was also having to accept my life story myself, because for so long, when you go through this, you're alone in it, sort of. Like you have the people in the cult with you. I had the people in the school, whatever. But a lot of it, you really suffer alone. And even when I wrote the book, I was alone writing it. Like, of course, I did notes and, you know, my publishers, you know, whatever. But when the book suddenly was in the world and it wasn't mine anymore, when it was everybody's, there's been moments where I want to be in denial, where I have to remind myself that I didn't make it all up in my dreams and that I really did go to that school. When the book hit the world, I think part of what made me just get so sad was that I knew that I could never lie to myself again, that it didn't really happen. I could no longer lie to myself. And part of the reason I wrote this book was because I knew that until I wrote this and until I put it all out on paper, that I was going to even wrestle with myself about, like, maybe it wasn't that bad. Like, maybe did it, you know? And I needed to, for myself and for anyone who was ready to read this, have it be out there, because I wasn't going to be able to move on with my life until I did. But I definitely went into a pretty dark depression for a second.
I think that's ultimately so good to have that kind of catharsis through the process of writing and like owning it fully, so you can never go back to that, which I totally relate to. Remember, Nippy, when I was being interviewed by Josh Block for that first podcast, where I was like, I said to him, wait, like, is this bad? Like, is this bad what happened to me? And I think that's also part of what these abusive regimes do to you, is they create the self-doubt. So you can't trust yourself and you don't know yourself and like right, wrong, good and bad. Everything's so crazy. And when you put it on paper, just so factually, it's one of the things I really liked about your book. It was very, oh God, a NXIVM, they used to call it data-based. Like, this happened, this happened, this happened, you know? And
well, because of journals and stuff, which I'm like, why'd you let me take those? I'm like, you gave me the book. People are like, how does she remember so much? And I'm like, because I have, like, every workshop exercise we ever did, we did a journal entry right after it. So I'm like, I have a CD of everything we heard. I'm like, they gave Brilliant. Me a book.
Very interesting.
Speaking of all the notes and everything, you wrote about something that we also did in our group, which is, you called it life story, and we had the life issue. And this is where I'm going to insert my own Chaps My Ass. You heard our Chaps My Ass segment. So Chaps My Ass is something that happened in our group that just, this just chaps my ass. And so we had to write this thing similar to yours about like what your life, we call it the life issue. And what chaps my ass is that we would write it and then show it to somebody and they'd be like, great. And you'd have to pass, someone would have to analyze it and you have to pass it before you can get promoted to your next stripe in our case. And someone would say, yeah, that's good. And then we'd show it often to this Lauren Salzman, who is also my best friend, which is very not healthy. But anyway, she would look at it and go, no. What would she say, Nip? Like, she'd be like, no.
You're not getting to the actual fear.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah. You're not getting to the fear. You're not getting to the root cause. You don't
and
really
that's what
get
drives
it.
Your behavior. And you don't really understand the behaviors you do to cover up your fear. I'm like, what?
Some bullshit word salad. So she was deciding whether or not we understood our own life struggles, also known as a life issue. So not to put you on the spot, but you've shared so many great little details about your experience at Carlsberg. Is there anything that you didn't share because it was just kind of silly or trivial? Or it could be something you did share, but what's the thing that chaps your ass about your experience?
I hope I tried to put a lot of chaps my ass in there. That was the whole Nippy won't notice, but there is a part in the book where like, okay, J. Crew, our pants had to be loose. And if your pants were too tight, a lot of us would like take our stuffed animals because those were like the only belongings we had and like stuff them in the back of the pocket, like the back of the pant. So like, it was like having a petting zoo in your butt. You'd like come into the mods in the morning and there's like however many girls walking around with like little pillows and animals in their pants, like doing squats, trying to stretch their pants up.
That's literally chapping your ass.
Yeah, literally chapping your ass. Or like, you know, my present day best friend and I, who at the school, we were close, but we weren't best friends because we were always on bands with each other. She was on a 6-month program. I was on 3 programs for 2 months. So we, when we were running crews, you know, at the scene where we were eating pizza and cinnamon sticks behind the dumpster, we were supposed to be throwing it away. So we definitely had moments of levity at the school. I mean, they were small and few and far between, but you know, I look back at like the stuffed animals and the pizza behind the dumpster and like sharing school store with Maya and, you know, the different things that, you know, we did with, you know, there's like a Mary Kay makeup party that some of the kids had, or, and I do laugh. I mean, part of the reason you survive these cults and these schools are because you put a lot of stock in those moments, even if they're 15
Absolutely.
Seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So like you hold on to that 15 seconds for a while, you know?
Yes. Yeah, I think as a reader, the thing that chapped my ass, like not in a laughing way, but the thing that just really...
By the way, I hope you did laugh
oh,
at least
yeah.
once or
oh,
twice.
No. Oh,
well,
God,
let me tell you the time I laughed the most is probably when you got in trouble for laying surface turd.
I knew you were going to say that.
Especially because with a family of so many boys, poo is such a hot topic around here.
Whoa.
Listen, you don't have to explain yourself, babe. But
do we want to start this?
Well, just saying that, so for those who don't know, in the woods, you had to shit in a hole.
Everybody else shit in the same hole. It was gross. That was abusive.
That was also abusive, okay, but an act of defiance, since you were oppositional defiance.
I did a hit and run.
A little hit and run. I get it. Well played.
When staff would find a surface dirt, they would make everybody stand around the pile of poop.
And you not laugh.
Well, that's what I'm telling you. This is what I laugh the most.
Everybody in the group had to stand around the poop and look at it.
Like a monument.
Yes.
It's like absurd.
Oh, Jesus.
I laughed a number of times, to be honest.
Trauma bonding.
The woods was abusive.
I laughed also, like, I mean, it's hard not to relate your, you know, what you went through to what we went through, but there were so many things like the ridiculous names for the workshops and how similar they were to our. Can you just give us like 5 off the top of your head?
Veneratio, Animus,
Integritus.
Oh my God.
Tinio, Veneratio.
And we had Keith named Claire Legatus because she was like the legal champion of the company. And we had Mobius, Ascension, Characterization. What were some of the other ones? Nope. Ethicist. They're just such
civilization.
I was actually going to ask you at what point in your recovery process did you figure out that not only was it abusive and culty, but the curriculum was actually from a cult, from Synanon, which we, by the way, discussed in our second episode. So our listeners should know what Synanon is.
I knew a lot of it was wrong when I was there. Like the 15-year-old version of knowing it's wrong. And I knew the fact I couldn't talk to my parents except on monitored phone calls. Like all of that was wrong. But I think I knew because my family and I, I fought with them a lot when I got out and would explode about how much I was, how they sent me there. I think it was more of a subconscious. I don't think it was at the front of my mind. I think I was pushing, I was doing so many drugs that I think I was self-medicating to run away from it, but it would come up and I would explode about it. It wasn't until my best friend from the school passed away that I really started researching and researching and was determined to understand everything. But I just could not stop. I became obsessed with digging. And her name's Charlotte in the book. Charlotte is my best friend to date. I literally was just with her yesterday. She was on her own warpath researching it, but for a degree at, she was getting it, trying to get master's and degree, on these schools. So we were both I would go drive up to San Francisco and we'd sit there for 4 days, reading everything and comparing notes. And we kind of uncovered together the cult aspect. And then a lot of her research was more based on that, while mine was timelining every single thing that happened to us and that we went through and, going through the journals and for instance, she was reading when she read the book for the first time in full, because she read it in pieces the whole time I did it. She was reading the workshops and she was honestly, now that I'm reading it like this, she was wow, but I can't believe how much I had pushed away and forgotten. But it was these journals that, literally mapped it out for me. They gave me a timeline of every workshop, literally every exercise we did. So she really got me on track on the Synanon aspect. And I really was I became a perfectionist, OCD. I wanted every detail about Synanon, every detail about every way Synanon tracked to Carlbrook. And I wanted every detail about abuse that we ever went through. Wow. So I have really been researching this topic for 7 years. And the book just came out 2 months ago.
Interesting. I think you'll enjoy Cultish if you haven't read it already by Amanda Montel. Her dad was in Synanon.
Yes. Oh, wow.
What would you say, and I don't know if it's proprietary to Synanon, or what would you say that through what you've uncovered is that you're the most sensitive to now? For me, there are certain abuses of power that I probably wasn't as sensitive to before my experience, but now I just have red flags go up and there's certain behaviors that language is being messed with. And Amanda Montel's book touches on that. Or I get really why are they doing that? Why do you need to fuck with language? What's your version of that? And then what wisdom would you say has come out of that since I've left? Because our language got messed with.
As is Elizabeth. Yeah. I mean, she has.
Yeah, as is yours. But I'm saying for me, that's the one I'm when I see it in news, when I see articles, even the way they're clickbaited, just how things are framed. That's the thing I'm most sensitive to now. And setting boundaries. I set boundaries pretty quickly now.
I have a problem with trust. Sometimes my managers are Elizabeth, you're going to have to trust us one day. I have a real problem with, I don't know if this is a trigger thing, but this is a way I've realized the school really affected me. I have a real problem with authority. I've waitressed, I've done everything, but I've fired from every job I ever had, because when I start to feel my boss is, or the person in authority is abusing it, I react very poorly.
Okay. So abuses of power by people in positions of authority sounds like.
I really quickly become a scorpion.
I get it.
And I cannot control it, but I do not do well with abuse of power. When people say that I deserved it because, I do every now and then read things. And when people say that, I was a problem child and wasn't that bad, or how much of this is true and not exaggerated? Those are things that used to really bother me.
That's going to come with the territory. And I can give you something that'll help you with that, because this is my chaps, my ass. I was studying for an audition. Sorry to get a little tangential here, but I think this will help. I had an audition about 3 weeks ago, and it was for a period of the 1920s. And so I go into YouTube and I look for 1920s attire, and I come across this video that basically covers New York City 1920s and has all this footage of New York City in the 1920s cut together for about 45 minutes. It has about 70,000 likes and then about 2,000 dislikes. And I'm going to myself, who the fuck goes onto YouTube
It's like New York 1920s.
And sees 1920s New York City footage and gives it a fucking thumbs down. Like, where are you in your day, in your life, where you have the time and energy to go, fuck that, I don't like images from 1920. So if there's naysayers when you're trying to be vulnerable and honest with your thing, there's naysayers about 1920s footage, you're going to get naysayers everywhere. So I just think if people have the predisposition to do that, I just remember laughing and going, 2,000 people took the time. So hopefully that contextualizes that for you.
I experienced that so much. And I'm just like, what? I've learned to laugh at, but that definitely played a part in my depression when the book came out. Cause I was like, who are you to tell me how I feel and like what I went through. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I've learned to just not read it. Like I've never responded to anybody. I was told very early on, just don't engage, don't respond. It is what it is. Now I don't care. Yeah. But there was a moment where I was like, who are you? Like, you're disliking New York. Like, you know, you don't know me. Now I'm like, you know what? You don't know me, so I don't care. Or you don't know me anymore. So I don't
recreational care. Outrage for these people. It's called.
Yeah, but the abusive power thing, I don't know if I'll ever get it.
Nippy reminds me too, like if I accidentally go down that rabbit hole and start looking at things, like there's always going to be people who find a problem with it. But when you put yourself out there, if you put your trauma out for people to analyze and criticize and look at, I mean, they're going to do it. But overall, that will always be outweighed by the positive that you're going to get from this book, you know?
Yeah, I've stopped. I still look sometimes because I'm human, but I've stopped caring.
Good. Well, if you ever need to vent, you can reach out.
The wisdom, I think, speak for Sarah when I say this, turning your experience, turning your trauma, turning all that stuff into wisdom and content for people to understand. How would you best describe how you've done that? Turn a negative into a positive. If you can elaborate, or if it's one sentence, what would you say is the biggest like caveat that you could share?
Well, I'm still a work in progress. I still have to remind
myself. We all are.
Somebody had to remind me that it's okay to not be okay. But I think the biggest takeaway that I've taken from all of this that I wish I knew at 15, if I could tell 15-year-old Elizabeth anything, I would have told Elizabeth that it's okay to not be okay, that it's okay to cry, it's okay to have a bad day, it's okay that people don't agree with you. Everybody has their own experience. So, you know, because this person doesn't agree with me, like it doesn't negate my experience or my feelings. So I still have very hard days with Carl Brook, with grappling with what I went through. But now I'm just like, you know what? Like I sometimes just cry out of nowhere. I don't know if you guys have that where I'm just like, how was that my life? Or like, how did my parents do that to me? Or like, I don't know. But I tell myself daily now, it's okay to not be okay. And like, that was my story. And if my purpose to coming onto this earth was to live through that, survive it so I could share my story for other people. So at least, I don't know if that'll ever make them want to share their own, but at least they know they're not alone. Mm-hmm. And that I'm okay with. I say very clearly in the book, if this keeps one family from sending their kid there, I will feel like I've accomplished something. And I've had multiple parents write me telling me they took their kid out of the woods. They're not sending their kids to a school. They're taking their kids out of a school because of this book.
Good.
I already feel like the book has served its purpose in that.
Absolutely. I hope you feel so good about that. I really do.
So like that, like why I did the book and why, you know, you do this podcast and why you do docs and whatever is because you hope it will just give one person the strength to know it's okay to not be okay. You aren't alone. And like, there are people that get it.
I found this quote on your Instagram and I loved it. It says, this is from Washington Post. Abducted from her bed in the middle of the night and sent to the woods to fend for herself, Gilpin shows how not to deal with mental illness. In surviving such treatment, she also shows how strong a mentally ill person can be. And I wondered, A, how you felt about that quote in relation to, you know, your purpose in shining light on these abuses. I wouldn't have used that term, but I guess maybe that's a blanket statement for depression, mentally ill.
It doesn't bother me. I mean, I was ill. I mean, I was not diagnosed and that's not my fault. I was 15. Mm-hmm. So no, I think it's true. I think that there are different extremes of illness, but depression is an illness and it's something that I still struggle with on a regular basis. As I said, I went into a depression after the book came out, like an actual depression I could not control. Where like my body was having, I like got physically ill. Like I threw up from anxiety and depression. So yes, I guess I have an illness called depression and I'm not ashamed of it. And if I bring nothing else into this world, it will be to tell people that that's fine. You know, if whatever it is, like nobody's perfect. We all have our issues and our struggles. And I think that's what makes each of us unique. And that's what makes our journey.
I loved it when I read it because I think it's sort of, for me, a bit of a fuck you to Carl Brook as well, because there's a irony to you coming out on the other side and being this person because they said that you were weak.
The people I find in my life, the saddest, the darkest, whatever the story is, those are the people I have learned the most from that have really struggled, especially that have struggled with mental illness. And I see more and more today, celebrities, athletes, whoever it is, people are coming forward and being like, yeah, you think I'm perfect and I'm so great and whatever, but I'm not. Like, I'm depressed. I won this tournament and then the next day was in bed depressed. And I think that that's important.
Yeah.
Because that is something I struggle with every single day is anxiety and depression. And it is something I will probably never stop struggling with because, you know, everybody has something. To circle out to Paris Hilton, I am not in contact with her. I would like to be in contact with her, but she is another example of somebody who has struggled a lot in her life and put off this persona of you know, I'm perfect and I'm happy and I'm beautiful and my life is great. And now she's been very publicly said, like, I'm not always okay. And I struggle. And this is my story. And I went through this and these were my problems. And I think it's really great. So I, you know, I wish more and more people would come forward and say what their mental illness was.
Well, she's the first person I heard about.
That was in line with the questions that I was asking. Is there like a group of people that people can support or something like that? Are you guys organized in that way too?
That's what I want to figure out next is like how to do that.
Okay.
But as you know, it's like a process. Like my came out. And when I was writing it and like doing the notes with my publishers, like I was not in a place to, that was hard. The writing, it was hard. The deadlines, it was, I mean, I left LA. I was like, I'm going to Nashville. Yeah. For, you know, I went to Montana like 4 times. I'm finally in a place where I'm able to collaborate and like work with other people and trust and whatever. I wasn't then. Now I'm ready. And I would like to find a support system and a way for everybody. You know, it's not until probably like in the last 2 weeks, I've been in a place where I could even do that. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
A book tour is like emotionally draining and, you know, the questions, you have to dig everything up and you kind of have to go there in order to explain it properly. Yeah, and that's triggering.
Come to terms with my own life story though. Like really finally be like, okay, this is me. This is who I am. I'm a girl that is mentally ill and beat it. And that's now that I've come to terms with that and who I am, I think now I would love, you know, that's why I'm on this podcast.
Sure. Yeah.
By us all talking, that will help not just cult survivors, but people in general, because there's a reason that you ended up in your cult and that my parents sent me to my school. Like people are always looking for something. People want to feel like they're a part of something and people are supporting them. And for my parents, it was the church. Everybody had a different thing. I want to bond together at this point.
Yes. Well, there may be some support for you. I think we mentioned this when we first spoke, but there's a community called #IGotOut. And that's a very supportive community with people who get out of, not just cults, abusive, anything. Yeah. And there's some resources there. Isn't the troubled teen industry, they have their own hashtag as well, right?
Breaking code silence.
Breaking code silence, that's right. So that's, I don't know what they're up to, but I think ultimately social media is, you know, as much as I hate it.
Yeah. I just see so many avenues that you could go down potentially, you know, particularly just from hearing you speak and what I feel like you're about is you were able to go down this avenue. It could open up a door about curriculum for teens that it's not in schools and is necessary. It's just so many things that you seem to be aligned with that I think would be interesting if you get this organized.
It's also ironic to me that so much of our mutual experience in the worst part of it is a lack of self-knowledge and like connection to self and like confusion about who the fuck we are, you know? And then doing this work is so self-defining, you know, when you're on the other side and choosing to speak, be public about it and to try to help people is, I think, at least for me, I don't have depression, but I do have a lot of anxiety. That's a lot of why we do the podcast, is to talk about these things, to have a roadmap of action that at least for me, that pulls me out of that and gets me in the present moment of like, what am I doing? And not like in the future or in the past, just like, what are we doing right now? And how does that serve what I want to say in the world? And it seems like you're doing
it. Yeah.
That.
And I have to say, I'm very, well, I'm honored you guys have me on your podcast, but also I think it's amazing what you two are doing. I think that I finally learned like what it really means to try and to expose something or to try and start exposing it. There's so much more that has to be exposed at these schools, but that just the cost that it comes with mentally and emotionally and just with yourself. I mean, I know it's not easy. And so thank you guys, because it's people like you that have paved the way for people like me, and that will pave the way for whoever is next.
And we had people reach out to us. So it's kind of,
yeah, we had people ahead of us.
The ecosystem was there for us when we got out and ushered us into this role, I feel like. So, you know, hopefully we're paying that forward a little bit.
Definitely inspire people like me, where I'm like,
which is the fun of it. That's great to hear. It's great to hear.
Yeah, so much of it, I think, is this fear that no one will believe you, or that, you know, they'll believe the abuser, not the victim. Because I think for a while, our culture was kind of set like that. And I think, you know, slowly, as all of us have come forward, I'm realizing that we're finally in a place where, you know, you can be heard, and like, people will support you and stand behind you and, you know, help you. I mean, you guys have really successfully just brought down your cult. I'm hoping that these schools come down too.
Well, if there's anything we can do to help with that too, like when we do post this episode, if there's hashtags or things that we can do to draw more attention to the right people, or in the show notes, if there's places where people can write letters or anything like that, like we are all you know, about action too, not just listening and going, wow, that sucks.
No, and I appreciate that. I'm like in awe of what you guys were actually able to accomplish.
Us too sometimes, right now.
Well, I'm telling you, we had a lot of people. We have a lot of really good people around us. Like I've said this in multiple podcasts.
When we got out.
We flirted with some really dark shit when we were in there, and we didn't really know it, but we felt it and felt the effects of it. And when we got out of the clutches of that, metaphorically, spiritually, however you want to say it, the light showed up. And I kind of feel like the balance was shifted there. And what you do with that and that help, you know, is, I think, your best way to honor it.
Yeah. And in regards to trust, if those people come in your lives that want life and want to help you, and, you know, I would say, you know, trust your gut on those people. But even like Taylor, our mutual friend, and Joy, who you know, introduced us, like these people just came into our lives and were so supportive, and we gravitated to that. But I understand with trust, like it's hard to rebuild after so many
years. Well, you can trust that you made enough of an impression on two people we know that they're like, just go on your podcast, right? Like there's inventory and there's actual experiences that you can go, okay, I'm doing something.
I'm a work in progress, like everybody else.
Yeah. Trust me.
I'm a work in progress.
Trust me.
I have terrible OCD.
I have OCD too, in my own weird way. I wish my OCD like had to do with me making sure my apartment was really organized. It doesn't extend there.
Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Jillian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
What is your main way of healing right now, since our podcast is so much about healing? So self-acceptance, it sounds like, and owning where you're at is a big part of it. But are you in therapy? Do you do any?
I have been in therapy since my acting coach required it to keep working with me because of everything I've been exposed to in my life. Mm-hmm. So therapy, self-acceptance is honestly a really big thing. When I catch myself like self-sabotaging, which I often do, because I, my whole life have thrived, you know, and like, not being okay. Like I got so used to not being okay, that now sometimes I find myself trying to sabotage all the good in my life and put myself back where I'm comfortable. So I have to catch myself not doing that. And I'm catching myself like not trusting people and just letting myself talk to people and being just really forgiving of myself. Like when I, you know, push someone away or whatever it is, I'm learning that it's not necessarily about forgiving other people. It's about forgiving yourself. And I read a book recently, which I highly recommend everybody reads, which is called Righting My Wrongs. And the whole prologue is about forgiving himself. And I sobbed the whole way through the prologue. I was like, that's been the biggest thing for me. Because even though I was a victim of a cult, of an institution, of a school, I blamed myself for like what got me there, what kept me there, who I became after, the way I behaved, treated other people, whatever it was, my decisions. It's been forgiving myself. And I found like, as I forgave myself, everything else kind of, the other issues start to work themselves out. They have a little bit less power each time. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that book recommendation. We'll add it to our show notes.
Yeah. I'm like, I love the book.
I hope our paths cross. Maybe we
have
a toast.
Nothing would make me happier. And I'm honored that you had me on here.
Thank you for taking the time.
And that you read my book.
I'm on it.
Tell our listeners all the places that they can find you and where the best places to get your book, et cetera.
Well, I only use Instagram. I'm not a Twitter person or anything. So Instagram is where you can find me. My book is at, I think, most local bookstores. I did talks at Book Soup in Los Angeles and Book People in Austin, Parnassus in Nashville. Obviously, I narrated the Audible, which you listened to. So you can get the Audible. It's on Apple Books, it's on Audible, it's on Amazon. I'm like, I think it's pretty easy to get.
Yeah. And we do encourage people to read it and review it. And we're going to do a book giveaway and maybe even an Instagram live to answer questions once this is out.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
See you on the flip side.
Yes. See you on the flip side. Bye.
See you on the flip side.
I don't know. I don't know why I said that.
Is that how you're ending our podcast?
I don't even know what flip side is. What is the flip
side? Flip side.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I felt like, again, we could just talk for hours and after we stopped pressing recording. And then after we stopped recording, we realized we forgot to mention that both her teachers and Keith had Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Well, for us, it was recommended reading for her. They had to read it. And it's such a good book. We're going to put that in our show notes. And also, if you know our story and you read the book, it's just the poetic irony of all of it is quite profound. I'm not going to say anything more on that. It's up to you to do your homework. Nibby.
That's right, Sarah. Get them to do their homework.
They could journal on it.
Yeah, journal on it.
So how about a little bit of word salad? Word salad.
A little word salad as it pertains to...
abuse. You know, one of the things that she got shit for in Carl Brook was for being weak. And I think, obviously, as she's proven to be quite strong, can you word salad weakness and strength?
Weakness and strength.
Ready, set, go.
It's interesting when people talk about the concept of weak. Some might say weak is simply limited to the physical realm. Some might say it's limited to the emotional realm. And some might even say if you could measure it, it would be limited or proprietary to the thought realm. So were I to be, say, limited emotionally, some might even say that might be my strength. So in essence, our weakness becomes our strength, and our strengths sometimes can be our weakness.
That's good.
And then understand.
And then you put the pinky up. Ugh, such a good word salad. Thank you guys for listening. Loved our chat with Elizabeth. And for those who are parents considering what to do with your troubled teen, start with therapy. Don't send them off to a boarding school or Outward Bound.
And if it falls under the umbrella of therapeutic boarding school,
reconsider. A little more research. Mm-hmm. Do a little more research.
Okay.
And check our show notes for how you can take action. Till next time.
Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the weight of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave. But I know.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped NXIVM, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.